This paper that that I became aware of, that our community became aware of, that was written by Dr. Ross, was presented to students in his class, and it was titled Notes on the Modern Assyrians. And that became a matter of concern to me and to several of us in the community, because we're concerned with what our young people learn about our own history from other people in this country, and we're having a hard enough time teaching them our own history ourselves, so we did not appreciate the sorts of comments that were coming.
Before we start, I'd like to introduce the president of the college, Dr. Tyree Weeder, to welcome you to the college.
Thank you, Leon. Several months ago, I believe it was brought to my attention that we had some information that had been posted on the college website or on a website by one of our faculty members that some members in the community found somewhat objectionable and felt that they had another side of the story to tell. So we had a meeting with this wonderful gentleman here, Mr. Farhad. Did I say that correctly? And good enough?
Farhad.
Okay. And we talked about, well, what could we as a college do to try to put some balance to the information that had been distributed. And so we talked about it and said, well, this might be a good way to do it, to have a forum so that people could come together and talk and exchange ideas. And so that's what we decided to do. We waited a little bit because it was during finals and the students were finishing up their finals, and then we had summer sessions. So this was the first time we were able to get everyone together. And that's what we hoped would happen today. So this is an opportunity for information and for people to exchange ideas. And that's what a college community is about. So in that light, I welcome you all here. And we wanted to have this tape so that other people could have the opportunity to watch it. So thank you very much. And I think it's going to be a very interesting period of time. Thank you.
As I said, I'm the president of the Faculty Association. I don't know anything much about this subject because my discipline is mathematics, but I'm going to moderate it, and so I'm going to introduce the speakers and let you know a little bit about the ground rules. On my left here is Mr. Fred Parhad. He's an Assyrian sculptor born in Baghdad, Iraq, and the Assyrian community worldwide has provided funding enabling him to create three Assyrian monuments which have been presented as gifts to the American people. The monument of Ashurbanipal, excuse my pronunciation, was installed in San Francisco in 1988. A monument of Queen Shumirum, called Semiramis by the Greeks, was accepted for installation by Chicago, and a third monument of Hammurabi is currently being made for Detroit. Mr. Parhad has kindly donated this sculpture to the college, and it is a representation which is particularly Assyrian. It is a bull's body with a king's head and wings. So we thank him for that. On my right is Dr. Kelly Ross, who is a professor of philosophy at Los Angeles Valley College, and he has been since 1987. He attended the University of New Mexico, followed by UCLA, where he got his bachelor's. And during his stay at UCLA, he spent 1 year at the American University of Beirut. And then he got his master's at the University of Hawaii and his PhD at the University of Texas. So the ground rules for this forum were that Mr. Parhad would present for 10 minutes, followed by Dr. Ross for 10 minutes, and then up to five minutes each if they wanted to respond to it, what each other said. And then if there's a microphone on the floor, if members of the audience would like to make a comment or ask a question, followed by responses of a couple of minutes each for each of the speakers. And then we would wrap it up with 5 minutes summation after that. So those are the ground rules for the forum. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Fred Parhad.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. This paper that that I became aware of, that our community became aware of, that was written by Dr. Ross, was presented to students in his class, and it was titled Notes on the Modern Assyrians. And that became a matter of concern to me and to several of us in the community, because we're concerned with what our young people learn about our own history from other people in this country, and we're having a hard enough time teaching them our own history ourselves, so we did not appreciate the sorts of comments that were coming. I would like to take this opportunity to thank Dr. Weider and Dr. Ross. They were under no obligation to do this. Dr. Ross did not have to agree to have a debate forum on this subject, and I think it was very forthright and forthcoming and be willing to do that. It seems to me there are some points in the paper that are significant. One of the overriding concerns I have is that we seem to be judging the past by the standards of the present, and I think that's a mistake whenever you do that. It's bad scholarship. The questions that I saw in the paper were the Assyrians more cruel or barbaric than any of their contemporaries? Another one would be, what was their relationship to the Hebrews? Another one is, are modern-day Assyrians related to the ancient Assyrians? Can they claim that? And who have the Assyrians influenced? Have they influenced anybody and any civilization past their own? And then, of course, the Bible and the Assyrians. Now, the period of time that I'm concerned with in this paper is the Neo-Assyrian Empire from about 1000 BC on, because that seems to coincide with the biblical tales that include the Assyrians. And it's from there that I think most of Western civilization has learned what they've learned about the Assyrians. Now, in the last 100 years of Assyriology, the predominant view has been whatever was written in the Old Testament about the Assyrians. Current scholarship is finding that there's a lot more in the cuneiform tablets that have been stored in the vaults of several museums around the world, from the British to the Berlin to the Louvre. Many of these are just being read. And what they're telling us about the Assyrians and their culture and their civilization has opened up many, many things about them that we never even dreamed of before. I certainly didn't. In many ways, I'm an ignorant person, but then I'm in good company. And there's nothing wrong with being ignorant, except if you insist on staying that way, then you're stupid. I've learned a lot in researching this subject, things that I didn't even know about my own culture, and for that I do thank Dr. Ross. And I hope that he can benefit by the things that we might be able to enlighten him about. The first point is, were the Assyrians more cruel than any of their contemporaries? I would like to reference an article by someone named H.W.F. Sags. He is an Englishman, he's a writer, he's written a lot about Assyrian history. He says in his article, Assyrian Prisoners of War and the Right to Live, that there's no comparative evidence that has yet been adduced to establish the commonly held belief that the Assyrians were inordinately and arbitrarily brutal towards conquered people. There's none. They merely suffered the misfortune of running afoul of one of the world's most effective and enduring propaganda machines, the Israelite prophetic movement, with its ability still to mold the thought of many in the Western world 2.5 millennia later. As an example, I don't want to make this a lesson in history. I mean, there are many, many sources I could refer you to, but I would just like to hit on a few of them and talk rather than read. He makes a comparison between King Saul and his war on the Amalekites, and you might also know of the Midianites, but let's stick with the Amalekites. The entire tribe of the Amalekites were wiped out, men, women, and children. They were wiped out because 200 years earlier they had crossed the Israelites as they left Egypt coming back. Everybody was killed. As Mark Twain said, not even the Comanches would do a thing like that. In contrast, the Assyrian kings reserved their harshest punishment for those who rebelled. They made a distinction between rebellion and crossing borders. If you crossed the borders into Assyria, you would be attacked. You would not be wiped out. Their use of violence against prisoners was judiciously used. It was not used indiscriminately, and they did not wipe out men, women, and children. it's a little odd to have to stand up here and defend my culture of 2,000 years ago, when all around me I can see a contemporary history, the treatment of people, prisoners included, that matches in barbarity anything we were accused of doing. Very often when enemy people were defeated, it was only the king and the royal family that were taken off to captivity. They were treated well. There is a passage in which the king Tiglath-Pileser warns his general, who is in charge of the prisoners of war, that if any of them come to harm, he will mean his life. The basic difference was that the Assyrians were not racialist. They accepted people of all different cultures and different religions. They had their temples in their capital cities, whereas the Israelites and their god Yahweh were tribal. Their god was for them and them alone. Ashur, the king of the Assyrians, was a universal god. When people were defeated, they were welcomed into Nineveh, into Ashur, and by the Babylonians into Babylon. They had temples built there of their own kings. Many, many an enemy king, Hosea for one, Jehoiakim for another, were taken to Nineveh or taken to Babylon. They lived there well at the king's expense. In the case of, I believe it was Jehoiakim, it was Nebuchadnezzar who took him and his royal family there, kept him for 37 years and released him to go back, still as king, to Judah. If you want to list Assyrian atrocities that the Bible claims happened, we could only go back 50 years and talk about what the Germans did, but we don't need to go that far back. We've had several instances of war recently, and people can be cruel. But there is no evidence at all, that the Assyrians were inordinately cruel or any more cruel than any people around them. And yet there is a lot more evidence that they treated their prisoners of war with much more consideration than was afforded to others. And a lot of it, by the way, was propaganda. There's a quote by Olmsted, another great writer in the field and a scholar. He says, Assyrians have been accused of spilling oceans of blood. They did so in their statistics. All historians know the statistics of enemy loss are enormously overestimated. Even in these days of statistical associations and professors of statistics, yet it has been the fashion of many Orientalists not merely to accept Assyrian statistics at face value, but if there was a choice of numbers, to take the higher. That's the point about Assyrians being more brutal than others at that time. In Dr. Ross's paper, there was also a statement which I found very offensive personally, and it said that the Assyrians killed more Jews than even Hitler did in percentage, not in total numbers, but in a percentage. This is the old notion that the Babylonians, more than the Assyrians, took away the 10 tribes of Israel and somehow they were lost to history. There were no 10 tribes of Israel taken away. Nebuchadnezzar took about 4,000 members of the royal family of the people of the Jews that he defeated. They were not subject to slavery. They were not mistreated in any way. There are several records of people going to work for Sargon II, the Assyrian king, going as charioteers, as mercenaries, as businessmen. The Assyrian Empire was the most wealthy and powerful one of its day. The city of Babylon was an amazing city. Many, many Jews remained in Babylon, even when Cyrus captured Babylon and set them free. Many of them returned. Many of them remained there. Jews have been in Mesopotamia since they were first taken there, and they have remained there. There were no 10 tribes. Cyrus Gordon, the Orientalist, has written about this, as have many, many others. This is a common myth, and it was mentioned in Dr. Ross's paper. There are many, many parallels in the Old Testament to Assyrian and Babylonian and even earlier mythology. The story of Moses and the reeds and the boat is the story of Sargon I, Sargon of Akkad, Sargon of Agade. The dreams that were forecast by Joseph, Pharaoh's dreams that Joseph told, Sargon did the same thing and much earlier. In the Epic of Gilgamesh is a mention of the precursor of Noah. His name was Napishtim. It was not Noah. The story of Genesis and many other of these myths can be found in Babylonian, in Assyrian, in Sumerian legends. It was the proximity of the Israelites to the Assyrians and the fact that the Assyrians had many garrison towns in Israel and much contact and commerce. Even next to Nazareth, there was an Assyrian garrison town. The Assyrians were universalists in the sense that they took people in and they spread their knowledge, their learning, their science among other people. They were not exclusively only for themselves. This enabled them to teach and educate many, many people. There are sources after sources after sources. I don't want to go through them all, but this is more contemporary science and archaeology than the papers that I think that Dr. Ross relied upon. There is much, much more current thought. I would like to read a letter from a Dr. Simo Parpola, who teaches at the University of Helsinki. Thank you. He says, "Dear Dr. Ross, two comments occasioned by your article, Note on the Modern Assyrians, which was brought to my attention by the Assyrian community of Los Angeles. Number one, the way the ancient Assyrians treated their enemies did not differ significantly from the way enemies were treated by the contemporary peoples in their world." Now, he mentions some sources in the Bible. And then he says that nobody denies the Jewish background of Christianity. However, there are features in primitive Judaism and early Christianity that cannot be explained without reference to Assyrian religion and royal ideology. The basic point here is that we have many Assyriologists who are experts in the field who know this field far better than Dr. Ross does. And for him to have written this paper and given it to our own students to read in his class and spread it among other students in the class, we felt was something that was wrong, and we're very happy that the college gave us this chance to respond to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parhead. Now I will call on Dr. Ross for his first 10-minute presentation, then we'll have 5 minutes each after that.
Dr. Ross. Well, I think I'm going to do this a little more informally than Mr. Parhead did. This doesn't like plant. Now, we're all here because of a protest about my webpage. A web page that was not given to my students, but was available for anybody who wanted to look at my website. Now, what I teach is philosophy, and what I teach in that is logic and ethics. And the kinds of critiques that I often have are about reasoning and about right and wrong. And the web page in question was a web page about the politicization of history and about a nationalistic history and a nationalistic use of history and sort of distortions that often happen when history becomes politicized and people want to idealize their own people or their own tradition or their own history. Now, the sorts of things that bothered me, that originally moved me to write that page, really a couple of them were already in Mr. Parhad's remarks. And one of them was just his mention of King Nebuchadnezzar as though King Nebuchadnezzar was an Assyrian. And Nebuchadnezzar was not an Assyrian. Nebuchadnezzar was a Babylonian. And also, Hammurabi was a Babylonian. Now, on my webpage, there are a number of examples of mistakes like that, of what I consider to be distortions. And I don't have sources with me here to list, but the sources are listed on the page and the website. Now, another what I felt was a confusion in Mr. Parhad's remarks was that the deportation of the 10 tribes of Israel was not done by King Nebuchadnezzar. The Babylonian captivity of the Jews originally under Nebuchadnezzar, that was many years later than the deportation of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now, if the question is, do the cruelties in the Bible meet or surpass or don't exist in comparison to the cruelties of the Assyrians, it is not my interest or business to defend the Bible as a work of ethics. In the Bible, God tells the tribes of Israel to go into the promised land and kill everybody. Well, I'm not interested in defending that. All I'm interested in is a neutral conception of history. And my objection is to an idealization of peoples in history. Now, one of the remarks I made on the webpage that Mr. Parhon and others seem to take particular exception to goes like this, as I did bring what the actual quote is. And it says, in sacred history, where it involved Israel, this, namely, and I have an example of the kinds of reprisals the Assyrians took against rebels, this could make the Assyrians as much the moral equivalent of Babylon, Pharaoh, and worse. Now, Babylon and Pharaoh are all condemned in the Bible because they do things, evidently they're not supposed to Israel. But the context there is sacred history. As if you are a Christian or a Jew, it doesn't matter whether elements of Christianity or Judaism came from ancient Mesopotamia, whether that was the Epic of Gilgamesh or something else, to believing Christians and Jews. They all come from God, even if there are these comparisons. Because after all, in Islam, if there are other religions that have elements that look like things in Islam, the explanation has always been, well, that did come from God independently. And I'm sure Christians and Jews want to say the same thing. Now you might wonder, well, why did that matter? Why was I talking about sacred history? Well, I was talking about the modern Assyrian community as a Christian community. And all of my remarks were addressed in that context. Now, if there are modern Assyrians who are not Christians, that just isn't going to mean anything to them. It's not relevant. And there's no reason why they should be protesting me about that, because I'm not interested otherwise in saying that the ancient Israelites were morally superior to anybody. Well, I think in a couple of matters maybe they were, but that could be argued independently. I would certainly not personally want to argue that all their religion comes directly from God. So really, there is a context to this statement, and I think the context gets overlooked. If we're going to ignore the authority that some people vest in religion, then what I would have to say might be very different. But anyway, in the passage, that's where it goes on to say, now not even Hitler, got rid of so large a percentage of Jews. Now that was quoted by Mr. Parhon as being that the Assyrians killed the Jews. And of course they didn't, they just deported them. But we don't really know what happened to them because they disappear from history. Now why did that deportation happen? Well, that was one of the practices of the Assyrians. Now, others had practiced deportations. The Hittites, even the Egyptians to an extent, had practiced deportations. Those are all part of imperial policies. And why did the Assyrians do stuff like that? Well, to break resistance. So Mr. Parhon mentioned that it's rebels that get punished. Of course, rebels to the Assyrians are, you know, an insurrection to the people who practice the insurrection. And it may not be the Assyrians were any crueler than anybody else, but they had the largest empire of the day. They had the largest empire that had existed up to that point. And the problem that creates is they had to do everything on a larger scale than everybody else. And so if there's resistance, if there is a rebellion in their eyes, then you kill the leaders, and you kill them with exemplary tortures. And then if that does not break the resistance of the community, you deport them. And that is not just something out of the Bible, that is extensively documented in Assyrian records. And the estimates by Professor Rue in ancient Iraq is that over three centuries, something like 4 million people got deported. Now, does that mean that I don't like the ancient Assyrians? Well, no. They were doing what other people did, but they were doing a lot of it. And okay, and why did I write about it? Well, again, the context was that if you are a Christian or a Jew, they are on the wrong side of the religious issue. If you just don't care about what Christians or Jews might think, well, then it's not relevant. It doesn't matter. The Assyrians were doing things other people did. But what we do have in the Bible is the testimony of one of the conquered people. Because really, it has not ever been very well explained why the Assyrian Empire fell. If it was so well governed, and it was so solidly founded, and it was so well supported, what happened? Well, one bit of evidence may be the Bible, may be the book of Nahum especially, that the Assyrians were hated by many of their subjects, even if the subjects were no longer able to resist or willing to resist. And of course, the kingdom of Judah never resisted anybody else until the Seleucids centuries later. Thank you.
Okay. Now for a rebuttal. 5 minutes for Mr. Barhead.
It's interesting. This is so obviously a Eurocentric view being expressed here. The first comments out of his mouth were that I didn't know who Nebuchadnezzar was, that I said he was an Assyrian. Rather than thinking he didn't hear correctly, he assumed that I, who am an Assyrian sculptor, who have placed monuments in cities and know damn well the difference between the Babylonians and the Assyrians, made that mistake. And second of all, Hammurabi was not Babylonian, he was an Amorite from the west. The idea that the ancient Hebrews were justified in doing what they did because their God told them to, but the Assyrians were somehow villainous because they did what their God told them to, strikes me as odd. One, people get away with saying, well, God told me to do it. I don't see why the others can't say God told me to do it and get off the same way. I'm kind of stunned by the complacent arrogance. I mean, if you're going to talk about the Assyrian Empire as being a very powerful, large empire that got away with murder, you might ask yourself about the American Empire. You might. Then again, you might not. It seems to me that empires do these kinds of things. And to level all of this against the Assyrian Empire, while not looking at other empires, could explain why there's so few Assyrians here. There are Sikhs who are being killed. There are Arab American Christians who are being killed now because the Americans are terrified. And the Assyrians are a little afraid too. I mean, I'm born in Iraq, and we have Assyrians who come from Syria and from Turkey. This is not the best of times to be talking about Assyrians as being violent and brutal and all the rest of it. To tell us that there's something wrong with us as Assyrian Christians if we find any pride in our ancestors is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. That's like telling an Englishman he should have no pride in his ancestors because of the things they did. I mean, it's just absurd. Or to tell a modern Jew that he should be ashamed of the ancient Jews because they killed every man, woman, and child because their God told them to. There is a wide disparity here. Assyrians, I guess, because of the way they appear in the Bible, are kind of fair game. I'll say again that there is far more current research than what Dr. Ross is familiar with. He is not an expert in the field, to say the least. And what upset us was that he was so complacent in putting out this article, which, by the way, he says in the paper, he did present to his students. It was written for that purpose. It was not only on a web page. And that the entire paper came about from a disagreement he had with one Assyrian student in his class. Our position still is that the things in this paper are inexcusable. And it will remain there. Is that my time?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was somebody's phone. But my concern more is with modern-day Assyrians, and that's why I took umbrage at this. I mean, there are all kinds of historical misrepresentations going on. I could care less. But to present this kind of view right now to our people, our young people in this country, I think is a terrible crime. And I'm surprised that the Academic Senate here, which has rules against doing these kinds of things, which says you should respect the students of a community, would allow this to happen and would maintain that there was no big deal, when the Assyrian students in our community would certainly be upset to be told that the people who taught them their history are frauds. I don't know who taught you your first history, but my parents taught me mine, and my grandparents. That's not a nice thing to say about people's parents. I doubt if you would have said that about any other ethnic group that I can think of that goes to school here. This is a fantastic time to begin teaching people about the different kinds of people who make up America. It's not just Germans, and it's not just Irish and French. There are a lot of people from the Middle East who are now Americans. And as you can see by what's happening, a lot of them are feeling targeted and are being targeted. So this would be an excellent time to stop engaging in this sort of thing, to not insist that I don't know who the king of Babylon was and that Nebuchadnezzar was an Assyrian. I know better than that. But I also know that the Assyrians also ruled Babylon as the Babylonians ruled Assyria. There was intermarriage, and this deportation you speak of was to the benefit of many people. As I said, Jews, many of them did not return to Judea but chose to stay in Babylon. And there has been a Jewish community there since that time to this day. I'll end on that point.
Okay.
Dr. Russ for 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, yes, of course, Hammurabi was an Amorite because the first dynasty of Babylon was an Amorite dynasty. But they are regarded as Babylonian because they became the first dynasty of Babylon. Now, what I was objecting to, I didn't know whether Mr. Parhad knew whether Nebuchadnezzar was an Assyrian or not, because he did not make that clear. And that is one of the things that I was objecting to in my paper that I had noticed in the nationalistic Assyrian material, that these kinds of things were not being made clear, that a clear distinction was not being made between Babylonians and Assyrians or other ancient people. And since one of my students had said that these Sumerians were Assyrians when they certainly were not, Assyria didn't even exist yet when the Sumerians got started, that is what was bothering me. Now, about this Eurocentric business, I don't really know where that's coming from. If there was anything I was discussing, it would be a bibliocentric view, which I was not endorsing, but merely describing. Now, as for the Bible as a propaganda machine, well, maybe so. But the Bible is no more and no less a propaganda machine than is any other ancient record. The Bible, you can say, as a work of history, is self-centered and self-serving, but then all other ancient records are. And as for the idea that deportations were good for the people that did them, well, any empire has some good effects. But when people are deported, they usually don't like that. They may end up accepting it later on. But I really don't want to get into details of arguments about that stuff. It doesn't matter. Now, my point in the paper was about ethnic mythology, about leaving some details unclear or distorting history. Now, the thing about nationalism is it makes for friends and enemies. And now the friends and enemies of truth may be a different thing, but when the issue is truth, then that's dealt with merely by argument. Now, the modern Assyrian people historically have suffered and have enemies, have been massacred, have been driven out of their homes. And the people who have done that in the 20th century and earlier were Turks, Kurds, Iranians, Arabs. But you know what? I don't think that the Jews have been inflicting any evils on the Assyrians. And the idea that the persecution of the Assyrians has been motivated by the Bible, I find that very unbelievable. I think that the problem that the modern Assyrians have had for 1400 years has simply been militant Islam, and that will continue to be a problem for all Christians in the Middle East. But if my problem is just being Eurocentric, then I don't understand why there is so much hostility and so much conflict among Aramaic-speaking Christians from the Middle East, because the modernist Syrians are not the only Aramaic-speaking Christians. They're Chaldeans, they're Aramaeans, and there is no reason, there's no reason why there should be hostility between those peoples. They have a common interest, and they are natural allies. And I just wonder, and the kind of page I wrote is simply asking why there is this hostility. Why is it that there are conflicts with people who really have no reason for hostility towards the modern Syrians? Why are Christian Aramaeans angry at a lot of modern Syrians? Why are a lot of Chaldeans angry at a lot of modern Syrians? And it's all because of this nationalism. And that was my moral critique about the evils of nationalism.
What we propose to do at this point is there's a microphone down here. If anybody would like to make a statement or ask a question, you could address it to either speaker or both, but both will get an opportunity to respond to the question.
About Chaldean and Syrians, we are not the same, and so forth. We have no problem. And I just want to know where you got this information, first of all, and how much you know about the Syrian Chaldean.
Well, I've actually learned a lot more over the summer, and where I've heard about it, of course, is from members of the Syriac Orthodox Church and from Chaldean political activists. And I know people who've been visiting websites where there are exchanges and arguments about all this stuff.
Would you like to say something?
Yes, I would. I didn't know we were the only people who had disagreements among ourselves. You may want to ask the Irish why they're killing each other. They don't seem to get along either, and they have good reasons to bury the hatchet, some of them sizing each other's skulls. Why are we being held to a higher standard? There are disagreements in our community, so what else is new? There are many Chaldeans. My grandfather was Chaldean. I have no problem with it. There are many Chaldeans and Assyrians who get along just fine. We have people in our community who have all kinds of issues with each other. Our own history is more or less a secret to us. The final versions of it and the details of it are only now just being uncovered when these tablets are being read. So it shouldn't be surprising that Aramaeans and Chaldeans and Assyrians and Syriacs and Afroyoyos and Troyoyos and Suryoyos are all having disagreements. Isn't everyone else?
Let me give you a little bit of information about the Syrian. I think this is good for your information. You said that some of the Syrians are not Christian. Well, that's a wrong statement here. King Abdur V was the last king of the Syrian that accepted Christianity, and obviously he had no Bible and nothing. And it's in there that King Abdur wrote a letter to Jesus to come to his territory because he was about to get killed. And King Abdur wasn't well. But they took the letter to Jesus, and Jesus said, I don't have time right now to come and tell him that if he believes in me, he's going to get healed. And so he did. And he accepted Christianity, and after that, we can all become Christians. You cannot find Assyrian Muslims, or Assyrian Jews, or Sikh, or whatever. They're all Christians.
Now, I remark that not all Assyrians were Christians. I would never have said that until meeting Mr. Parhad, who told us, well, he's not a Christian. And that was a little bit surprising to me. And I'm not a Christian either. And I'm not sure that's relevant unless everyone thinks I'm here to defend the Bible. And in all of the emails I received, many people said, oh, you would only be saying what you are because you must be Jewish or a Zionist. Well, no, I'm not a Christian, and I'm not Jewish, and I'm not even a Zionist. So all I am interested in is history, which is not distorted by a nationalist agenda.
The whole point of this is that the basis that you are using, the things that you are using as reference material, are either the Bible, which I personally reject when it says anything about Assyrians, or there are sources that are fairly antiquated, and I don't think you're current on the most recent
kinds of things that are coming out and will be coming out in far greater numbers. That's my main objection. Just to show you the disagreement among people, I disagree with Walter completely. I don't buy the King Hagar story at all. It makes no sense to me. At the time of Jesus, there were no Christians. Jesus was a Jew. Christianity didn't come into being until at least 100 years after Jesus died, maybe 80 years at the most. People were Jewish then. The idea that the letter came to him and turned him into a... I find it very odd. We are people who are very proud of the martyrs that we've given who have died because they were Christian. We have them, they're extolled. There was a mother who saw her seven sons have their throats slit rather than deny Christianity. But I find it odd that we praise ourselves for having so quickly jumped from our Assyrian religion, which had brought us through 2,000 years of civilization at the top of culture and everything you could imagine, and yet we're so glad we threw it over because one king wasn't feeling well and received the letter and got better. I mean, I can't understand how on the one hand you praise us for one thing and then we condemn ourselves for another. I mean, it confuses me, no end. So we have disagreements in our community also. And no, I'm not a Christian.
Okay.
In your paper, you mentioned Ruth as a source, and you quote some things out of writing of his, and then you say that maybe he was too kind on the Assyrians, or too soft on them, and you skip over that. In a letter that you received, actually, by Zach Cherry, who's an Assyrian student studying Assyriology, he goes on to quote some more from the same book, the part of it that you left out. It must be noted, however, that those atrocities were usually reserved for those local princes and their nobles who had revolted, and that in contrast with the Israelites, for instance, who exterminated the Amalekites for purely ethnocultural reasons, the Assyrians never indulged in systematic genocide. That's from the same source, but you left it out.
Well, that to me, that is the quotation out of context. I think Ru likes the Assyrians, but that's actually one of the most positive things he says about them. They did not engage in systematic genocides, and evidently they didn't. They preferred not to depopulate areas, but to deport people, and then to deport other people back to fill up these spaces. But reading through Ru, what you get is that at least the Assyrians claimed occasionally to commit genocides because Ashurbanipal boasted there were no Elamites left after he had gone through with Elam. And now we would not know that there actually were Elamites left without the Babylonian records, which involve the actions of the Elamites after the Assyrian conquest. So we can argue about our sources, but that is an argument. That is not a protest. And consulting with Assyriologists and Assyriac scholars over the summer, I would not want to name them. I would not want to name many of them, as many of them have been subjected to harassment and threats from Assyrian nationalists. And I think very much like the kinds of harassment that I've been getting over this issue.
I have the exception to that comment because the impression it leaves is that you are not at liberty to give the names of these people because what we might do to them. I mean, this is going from bad to worse. Is it some personal animus you have towards the Syrians? Possibly? I mean, I don't understand why you're so bound and determined, as Dr. Parpola, who I guess you don't consider to be an expert in the field, although he reads cuneiform and goes to primary sources, not secondary ones. He ends his letter to you by saying, I do not know the reason which led you to start this crusade of yours against the Syrians who take pride in their past, but I am alarmed by the lack of critical judgment displayed by you. Do you really believe that you, a layman in matters of Syrians, are competent to tell a nation the ultimate truth about its history? I can only hope that you show better discernment in your own trade. Believe me, the Assyrians can read the secondary literature on Assyria assembled by you as well as you, and many of them know more about these things than you do. Sincerely, Simo Parker, Professor of Assyriology, University of Helsinki, Director of the State Archives at the Assyria Center of Excellence. There is a lot of research coming out of Finland. There are conferences held there annually to which many of our Assyrian people go. They contribute to these conferences. There's another one in October in San Francisco. There's so much more in this field than what Dr. Ross knows that it's surprising to me that he still insists on maintaining the same tone that he did in his paper. I'm really surprised at it. Sure. Syriac to me, the language is Syriac. So the reason that you will see a whole bunch of different so-called nationalities, but they are all called Assyrian,
when you want to lift up a nation, you just want to break it. And the way you break it is by religious unity. So the Church of the East was the first church, and we were all from that church. And if you go to all these churches, if you go, and you go listen to the sermon, they're all the same. They're all the same sermon. And they all speak Aramaic, the same language. And their books is the same alphabet. And they have the same traditions. So when somebody says, I'm Chaldean, or I'm Syriac, or I'm so-and-so, this is when the religious people, patriarchs, start pulling these people on the side to try to have their own power. That's when you break a nation. We're all Assyrians, because I speak the same language of Chaldean, a different dialect, but we speak the same language. Obviously, you haven't done your research so far, and you should have done that before you go to the temple.
Of course, what these people you're referring to deny, as that they are Assyrians, that is the point. You can accuse them of being deceived somehow by their religious leaders, but they deny that also. And when I began all this, which was not a crusade, because the issue of modern Assyrian claims about history was just one of the examples on my webpage. Other examples were things like modern Greeks claiming that the Romans were Greeks, and a few other things like that. So I was trying to be an equal opportunity critic. But for what you're saying, you've got an argument with them, not with me.
No, I'm going to have an argument with you because you wrote this paper.
I wrote the paper. I didn't even realize when I wrote it that there were these kinds of disagreements. I was perfectly willing to accept the word Syrian as being used for all modern Aramaic-speaking Christians, but I discovered, somewhat to my surprise, that this is hotly disputed. And the whole issue of the use of these names is an issue that is open to historical inquiry and is dealt with by scholars who maybe don't read ancient Assyrian, but who do read Syriac. And as I mentioned, and there was an objection, but I have been told that modern scholars of Syriac run the danger of being protested by their conclusions. And the sort of hostility I was talking about is a hostility about the use of these words.
Mr. Potter?
I still don't see what bearing that has on the fact that someone who admits he's a layman in these things doesn't know it very well, doesn't read the original language, even as he admits he was surprised by things he learned after he wrote this paper, would write such a paper and put it out there for people to read, in which he calls those who teach us what we know frauds. I just don't understand why you would use that kind of language. I can't imagine any kind of a scholarly word where someone says, whoever taught you to respect your heritage and your history must have been a fraud. I don't understand it. That's why I wonder if there's something personal in this, because it just doesn't seem passionate, doesn't have a distance from the subject matter, and he still keeps insisting that because of some disputes among ourselves, first of all, we're not supposed to do that. In order to prove who we are, there are several hoops we have to jump through. And I don't understand that. I mean, what's an American? What's an Englishman? Is the Englishman of today anywhere near what Shakespeare's Englishmen were like? When did they start being English? Why do we have to prove anything to anyone else?
For me, there's philosophy, and I think we should have wrote this letter based on philosophy, not historian. But we have a certain Percola that he is really a historian, and he knows what he's doing. At least ask some other scholar not to go to the church and ask the church people what you think.
Well, I have asked other scholars.
And name I know all of them. I know all the scholars.
Well, let's see. My objection to Professor Parfala was not his information. I'm sure he knows all the primary sources. My objection to Professor Parfala was his reasoning, and that is what I teach. And why the passion I have about this is my objection to you nationalistic appropriations of history. Now, they can use history to bolster this self-esteem if they want to, and I'm not going to bother them. I was not bombarding anybody with email, but I got bombarded with email. Now, you might not like what I had to say, and you can condemn it for all you like on the internet, but I had my points to make.
So the response to that is the points you have to make are based on information that is antiquated in most cases, and for the rest is highly subject to dispute, and you are not qualified to join that dispute.
Is that all your questions, or?
Well, my last question to the professor is he going to keep that paper the way it is?
Probably going to rewrite it.
Can we consult with you when you rewrite
it? The Marian language was unrelated to Akkadian or Babylonian or Assyrian or Aramaic. The affinities of Sumerian are unknown. There were a lot of other languages in the area at the time that also have unknown affinities, like Kassite and Elamite and Urartuan. And there are modern languages that survive in the area in the Caucasus. There are three different language families in the Caucasus that are unrelated to anything else that anybody knows of. Languages like Georgian and Circassian. There are no known affinities of those languages. The speculation is that maybe they're related to these other languages that have no known affinities, but there isn't enough material about the Caucasian languages, about their history, to be able to trace those connections.
Part of the problem with all this is that the information is scanty, and much, much more of it is going to start being available now than it has been before. So, for my part, rather than arguing about things that I can't prove, and Dr. Ross can't prove, and maybe many Israelis can't prove just yet, there are many tantalizing things on the horizon. I would assume skip to the problem for modern-day Assyrians, because that's what I saw in the paper that Dr. Ross wrote, what it presented to Assyrian young people who may be trying to evolve or develop an identity as Assyrians in the modern era. That was my concern more. I'm content to leave it to the experts in the field to battle this thing out and to read these primary texts as they're going to be doing. For the first time, by the way, these cuneiform tablets in the thousands are going to be available online for scholars all over the world to read. And I have a feeling that, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're going to reveal an awful lot about biblical sources and about history, too, that is going to be very fascinating in times to come. But I would rather focus on what the modern-day Assyrian has to do, deal with it, look forward to, than stay in the past so much.
My name is Russell Baird, I'm also a philosophy instructor. I'd like to remind the audience here at the beginning of our guest presentation. What I heard was a terrible reprimand from the Dalai Lama Chapter of Dissent for failing to censor free inquiry of the faculty. And that seems to have hampered the entire exchange. What I'd like to ask is if Mr. Farhan was good enough to state safely in the form of a source review the disagreement with Dr. Ross's stated position. And then I would ask if Dr. Ross was good enough to state what I think he did one most of was the misreading of the context within which the remarks were made. Because at this point it seems that we've lost sight of seeing the truth. We seem to be very concerned about somebody's feelings and what is making some people uncomfortable, rather than stating the what is the true and what is the false narrative here. And I don't see a source for the two of you, whatever you might need to know, clarify that for me. Because I thought I heard you asking what was reprimanded for that consent, but not censure. So I made a mistake.
I don't like censorship in any form. When Dr. Ross modified his original paper to please us, I was very upset. I wrote to him and said, no, that's not what we want. We didn't want censorship. That academic freedom is about doing what we're doing just now. We're disagreeing. It's not about cleaning it up and changing it. So I was not reprimanding. I was just saying that we asked for a copy of the academic consent rules, and one of them was that you show respect to your students. And I did not feel that the paper that he issued for his students, as he said, rather than argue with them in class in the future, you merely hand this paper out to them, which is not just to them, but to their neighbors, the ones that they have to grow up amongst. And for them to have to read that the ancient Assyrians, our ancestors, proportionately or percentage-wise, killed more Jews than did, if you put us in that same category, is not a way of showing respect to our youth. So I was critical because I felt that the Senate has a responsibility to say that, no, that is disrespectful to the Assyrian community.
Please, remind us, state it succinctly, this is really informed by the consortium people who've talked about positions.
You're all a little far removed from this subject. To use an academic exercise, it would be very much like someone sitting up here now telling you the real history of what the United States has done in the Middle East that might anger people enough, you know, to do what they did. You don't want to hear that right now. You're understandably outraged, as we all are, that innocent people's lives would be snuffed out. For us, this is blood and guts. It's not just an academic exercise for us. Because sometimes you do get tongue-tied. Sometimes our feelings are involved. Because our position in the Middle East is that we're a minority. We're caught now between the Muslims and the Christian West. By the way, in the last 12 years, I've been Christians attacking my homeland and managed to kill more of my people than I think Muslims have for a long time, percentage-wise. So it's a very, very important subject to us, and when we see something written like this that is still being defended and is being, and as you're saying, well, this is just a point of view, to us it's more than that. So, and I still maintain, had we been African American, or had we been Jewish, or had we been American Indian, I think there would have been far more sensitivity on your sentence part than the fact that we're just a bunch of Assyrians and we can't prove anything anyway. And when we bring you experts in the field who are not Assyrian, who are truly experts in the field, I mean, Dr. Parpola runs the Malamu Project, which involves lots and lots of scholars from around the world. And this is serious stuff. This is not somebody teaching UCLA for the last 25 years, you know, who was set in his ways. This is new stuff. It's cutting-edge stuff. So it's going to become more readily available as time goes on. But it's an emotional thing with us. I mean, you hit us at our core. So I think we're doing very well in maintaining. So if you want to know what it is exactly, I disagree with Dr. Ross's position.
No, I would like to be.
Yes, I think of his sources,
he is presenting fairly stable narrative of people's tradition. And what I'm asking is serious, what is inaccurate in his presentation? That's what I suggest to get my hands on.
Well, I don't want to read chapter and verse the sources. I mean, I can give the book. This is a book right here that has numerous sources in his bibliography, and they contradict almost everything that he has said, including the 10 tribes of Israel business, including the deportations and how many people were deported and all the rest of it. I mean, it's just chapter and verse. The man is wrong in almost everything he says, but this will become more evident as time goes on. A lot of this research is new. For the last 100 years, Assyriology has been conditioned by studies of the Old Testament. These tablets were not read in their entirety. We only recently found out that the ancient Assyrians had a menu, had a variety of foods that they ate that was incredible. There was a researcher who wrote a book on it. He read and died, unfortunately, after doing this. He was in his 80s, but he read some of these tablets. They had 300 different kinds of bread that they made. Several of the breads shaped in body parts, human body parts, appetizers, beers, wines. I mean, locusts and honey was Jewish takeout. It was a much, much more refined civilization than any of us have known. These people who are on the cutting edge of research are beginning to know this, and they are publishing their works, and they'll become more readily available with time. But I would disagree with the position of someone who says that he's a layman in the field, not an expert, who's read secondary sources and can't read the original sources, coming out with a statement that uses words like fraud.
But Dr. Ross responds then.
May I make one final comment? Just be, would you want to record that, stating that you would not like the ballot call exactly ever to send to anybody on the basis of whether or not it makes any individual or who feel bad
Just do what you've done. You know, give us a chance to respond and then reconsider whether you would take the same stand with any other ethnic group if they're young people and the parents of those young people pay taxes to your school felt that those people, their children, have been insulted by this paper. Just treat us the same, and I think that's all we'd ask for.
I was pretty right about it. They're insulted every day.
You probably deserve it.
Dr. Ross?
I do.
They're insulted. I'm not.
Again, I keep being accused of not knowing about the material. Maybe I don't. Maybe Mr. Harhoff, who I don't think is at this point either. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he knows more than I do. Maybe he doesn't. I have not seen anything that the Sumerians did not practice these deportations, and the purpose of them was to break resistance of the conquered people and assimilate them. Now, I've also said that others did that. Others did that. And the context of my remark in the paper is the way this could be regarded by Christians or Jews, for that matter, who regard the Bible as authoritative. Now, it doesn't make it a reliable source of history, but it's as reliable as a lot of these sources from other ancient people, as all ancient people write history in a self-serving way. And if the Assyrians boasted they killed more people than they actually did, well, then that's better for them. But the overall context of my remarks was using nationalism to politicize history and to introduce an ideological litmus test on certain issues. And I'm certainly very passionate about that. But I don't like to see arguments about history become politicized on that. But they are that way. Now, as for whether I'm setting out to be offensive to the modern Assyrians, I carry around with me a coin. It is a Chinese coin minted about 1896. On one side are Chinese characters, which tell you the year in which the coin was minted, and also tell you that this is a legal tender, basically. Then you turn over the coin, and on the back is another alphabet. It doesn't look like Chinese characters. And I think anybody looking at it would have no idea what it is. So what the hell is that on a Chinese coin? Well, you know what? That is the name of the mint in the language of the Manchurians, who were the last dynasty of China, and they wrote their language with an alphabet that they had gotten from Christian missionaries from the Church of the East. Now, to me, and a lot of other people, that is the most fascinating thing about the modern Assyrians. They did things like that, that they distributed their alphabet across Central Asia, and some people are still using it. And me, all these arguments about the ancient Assyrians, nobody owns history. And what the Assyrians did has maybe some good effects, but it is not anywhere near modern history. And nationalizing that history seems to me bad thing and unnecessary.
I think when more is known, you see that the Assyrians had a lot to do with influencing both the Israelites, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and they influenced the Greeks and the Romans, and they had a lot to do with influencing the civilization that you're enjoying right now.
The hostility among Chaldeans, Armenians, and Assyrians that you mentioned in regard to nationalism. You said you have sources that you would not like to share with us.
One of them is a letter posted on my website from a man in the Netherlands, Johnny Messa. He wouldn't mind me mentioning his name because he says he's had dealings
of people. But in that context, Professor Parpola wrote a letter to Mr. Meso, telling him that he was an Assyrian. And talk about offensive. I think all of you who are Assyrians would be very offended if anybody told you you are using the wrong name for yourselves. And there are people who are willing to do that. But why is it any less offensive that Professor Parpola should go out of his way and write a letter to a private individual in the Netherlands telling him that no, he is not an Aramaean, he is an Assyrian. And I think Mr. Meso and many like him find that offensive.
There
are many, many Chaldeans who also admit that they are Assyrians. This is a designation that came much later. They can't possibly be related to the ancient Chaldeans. There's a lot of back and forth in our own community, and there are a lot of Aramaeans and a lot of Chaldeans who are very, very adamant about this. I think that some of the Assyrians in our community deserve a little bit of that because we tend to be very arrogant about insisting. I don't insist. If they want to come to get Chaldean, I accept. If they want to be Aramaeans, it's okay by me. It's an active verb. As long as we work at our culture, I don't think we care what we call each other, as long as we're willing to do something about it. But this disagreement doesn't exist with the community.